Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 124 of Allied Strategies. My name is Tristan. Joining me, as always, is my good friend Benjamin.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome back from the Pro Tour, Ben. And not joining us this week is Neil, who is not joining us this week because of unforeseen circumstances that he probably could have foreseen if he, you know, valued us as friends and podcast partners. But no matter, Benjamin, we will sally forth without Neil this week, just you and I.
So how much
quality time together? Yeah.
How much worse do you think this episode is going to be on average because Neil isn't here?
Well, maybe, you know, 20 to 25% worse. That would be my guess. What do you think?
Less than 30%.
Yeah.
Less than 33%.
No, I don't think he cares. You know, I don't think you could cut any one of us and diminish the show by that much.
I see.
I think any two of us.
Yeah, or, if you cut any two of us, it probably tanks to like, you know, 20% or whatever, right?
Like the noble triangle. If you just take away one of its sides, it's still really a triangle.
What?
The noble triangle, Benjamin. One of nature's great shapes. And, yes.
And that's the end. That's our end story.
Anyways, welcome back from Spain. How was your Pro Tour?
My Pro Tour was the definition of slightly above medium.
Okay.
I went 9-7. That's one match above a 50-50 record. And that gives me one pro point. Well, it actually gives me four, but you get three as long as you're not disqualified from the event. So,
which has happened before to people who only needed three. Those stories are real heartbreakers.
Well, depends. That depends on whose side you're on.
That's fair.
But yeah, I mean, it went very whatever, and it was really far away. And in a country that doesn't apparently have any internet, as far as we could tell. So it was like kind of whatever. It was definitely not my favorite Pro Tour. But, you know, it's still fun to hang out with friends and see people that you don't see all the time. So I had fun.
Great. I'm very happy for you. And that's what we're going to be talking about today on Allied Strategies, is we're going to talk about your Pro Tour testing experience. You know, Modern and the decks you picked. But first, got a shout out, you know, Jacques. Posted a comment on one of our recent episodes, and you just really, you know, this is for you, Ben. He was really engaged by your proving NP complete some stupid nonsense about some card that nobody's ever heard of and how you used it for a math proof. So, despite what Neil and I thought, there's a number greater than one of people that are interested in that. So,
you know. Awesome. Well, I'm glad that they liked the show.
We also have some good friends of the podcast to thank over on Patreon, Adam, Matt, Sean, and Brett. Thank you for your continued support. And the four of you, of course, if you'd like, can send in a Patreon card of the week, and we'll do that in our flagship segment, Card of the Week. But for this week, we only have two cards of the week. Ben, what is yours of those?
I mean, I see three written
down
here.
Okay, yeah, we've got a special surprise card of the week at the end, but we've got two real cards of the week. Ben, what's yours?
So my card of the week is Tomb Robber. Tomb Robber is a 1/1 Menace Pirate for 2 generic mana and a single black mana. It also has 1 generic mana, discard a card. Tomb Robber explores. And I'm going to talk about this card because it kind of does not look great in Limited. You know, you look at it, you're like 3 mana for a 1/1. I mean, I get that it has Menace, but like, that's not very good stats. And like, discarding a card to explore, is explore really worth a card? I'm not sure, you know, so this card looks like it's kind of bad. I actually think this card is pretty good and Limited. So one thing to note is that when you discard a card, if you explore a land, you know, it just replaces itself automatically. So as long as you have the mana for it, you can just keep exploring until the top card of your library is a spell, right? So this guy basically makes it so that you don't draw lands very often because you just keep discarding them.
For every land you draw, you're guaranteed to draw at least one non-land. Because you can just discard.
Yeah, if you have enough mana.
Yeah.
And that effect is kind of powerful and Limited. Also, I think it just actually can get pretty big if you just start pumping cards into it. Like late game and Limited, you just don't need. There's a lot of spells that are just kind of whatever, low impact that you don't really want. And you might just want to make like a bigger guy, for example. There's going to be a lot of games of limited where a 2-2 for 2 is worse than a +1/+1 counter. And like in those sorts of games, the Tomb Raider shines. And also, you know, it's a pirate. So it gets some tribal synergies. Like, I'm not saying this card's like a first pick bomb or anything, but I think it's actually pretty good. And I think you should play it if you're black and you have the card in your pool.
Oh yeah. I think it's very, very good. I'm all about this card. I think it's pretty skill testing. I think that it's important when you play this card to kind of understanding when to activate this ability is not an easy thing to do. And I think that most of the people I've played against who controlled this card made an obvious mistake with regards to activating this. So try not to do that. But if you can, like, if this thing gets up to 3/3 or 4/4 menace, like, that's a real threat. And at that stage of the game, your opponent can't even really set up a double block because you're threatening to just discard your hand until it turn all those into counters, right? Every time you make an attack with it. So it's very difficult to deal with. And once it's that size, it's a really fast clock. So yeah, wonderful card. Really underutilized, I'd say. Great card of the week, Ben. My card of the week is also a great card, probably about equally as good as Tomb Robber. And that card is Jace the Mind Sculptor, which Jace the Mind Sculptor is 2 BLUE & A BLUE for a legendary Planeswalker Jace. Starts with 3 loyalty. You can +2 to look at the top card of target player's library, and then if you want, you can put that card on the bottom of that player's library. You can 0 it to draw 3 cards, then put 2 cards from your hand on top of your library in any order. You can -1 it to return target creature to its owner's hand, or you can -12 it to exile all cards from target player's library. Then that player shuffles his or her hand into his or her library. So this card, I was inspired by the fact that it's being reprinted in Masters 25 to talk about it, because I've been playing this, been messing around a little bit with Miracles in Legacy now. You know, Miracles is a deck that took a little bit of a hit with the Sensei's Divining Top ban in Legacy, but there's a new powerful card, Search for Iskanta, which really slots into the strategy well, and the synergy between Search for Iskanta and Jace is actually quite impressive how much velocity you can get through your deck when you can set up the top card of your deck to be something that you want to mill with your search after brainstorming it back onto your deck with Jace the Mind Sculptor. So that's a fun combo. And yeah, just wanted to kind of, you know, people that think Jace the Mind Sculptor is a safe unban for Modern, I think, would be shocked by how powerful it is still. Because to this day, I've seen it in Vintage tournaments, and it's, you know, one of the most powerful permanents you can resolve in that format as well. Maybe it's not one of the most. It's a permanent you can resolve in that format, which is already a pretty high bar to clear.
I'm not really into unbanning Jace in Modern. I don't know. I just think the risk is not.
Yeah, I think Bloodbraid Elf might be safe, but I'm not sure on Jace.
Maybe. I'm fine with Bloodbraid Elf being banned also.
I don't really have a strong opinion on Bloodbraid Elf. I do think that one of Mox Opal and Ancient Stirrings is pretty likely to go in the next 18 months. So.
Really? I don't think so.
I think Mox Opal is the most powerful card in the format right now.
I mean, they're both extremely good, but yeah. I think they're kind of like appropriate power level for, like, you know, something has to be the best card in Modern, and I think that the power level of Mox Opal and Ancient Stirrings is, like, pretty appropriate for power level of best card in Modern.
I don't know. I'm not sure on the Mox Opal front. That card is really quite broken. Quite a strong card.
It's really good, but, like, I don't know. It's not like everyone is playing a bunch of Mox Opals.
But yeah, I bring up Jace as my card of the week because I was on the unbanned Jace train until I played it a bit in Legacy, and it's just so good there that I'm back on the Jace should stay banned train.
It's also just so miserable to play against. It's like all of your opponents are playing Lantern Control when you play this.
Right,
Jace.
Yeah, they go Jace, right, like, they plus on you, and then, you know, you don't draw anything, then they have enough time to brainstorm on the next turn, and you're just like, this is miserable, you know, I can't win, but it's going to take 12 turns, just like Lantern, before I can concede. Yeah. Also, I have seen a cool Legacy deck that plays, it's basically Lantern Control, but ported over to the Legacy. So in addition to Lantern of Insight, there's a single blue mana for a World Enchant that does the same thing. It's like Field of Dreams or something. So they have more access to more Lantern effects, and they have access to Jace the Mind Sculptor, and they have access to the Rest in Peace Helm of Domination kill combo that is in that deck, or in the version of the deck that I've seen, but Jace in that deck is very powerful, because you can, anytime you see with your Lantern or Field of Dreams a powerful card on top of your opponent's deck, then you can plus two it to the bottom, and otherwise you don't have to. So that's, you know, that would be, it would be really annoying to let current modern Lantern have Jace the Mind Sculptor. I think the card would be good in that deck. Although it's kind of a hard card to cast, maybe it'd get stranded in their hand and muck up their bridges, so...
I think Jace actually would not be good at Lantern.
I think maybe it would take, like, the Tezzeret Agent of Bolas sideboard slots.
Yeah, maybe, but, like, I don't think it would be good in Lantern in the sense that I've seen Lantern I've already seen Lantern decks lose a lot when they draw their one of Witchbane Orb.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They just can't cast and get killed even though they have bridge in play.
That's...
So I think more 4-drops is not actually what the deck wants, because it's not really hurting for ways to... like, mill the top of their library. Mm-hmm. But Jace would be good in, like, other decks. It would be very good in other decks.
Witchbane Orb, that's a card that you can lose if you draw in your Lantern deck. It's also a card you can lose because it was still in your sideboard when it shouldn't have been.
Well, he didn't actually lose, right?
He got a game loss for that.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh,
blowout. He just went on to win the next two games still. But he was searching his library, and the ruling the judge made is because... he had one Grafdigger's Cage main and one in the side was... what was listed on his deck list, and accidentally he had switched his sideboard Grafdigger's Cage for his mainboard Witchbane Orb, so then he had two Grafdigger's Cage in his deck, so the judge's ruling is that because they couldn't tell which Grafdigger's Cage should have been where, then it was a game loss instead of normally being downgradable. Not sure what I think about that, but either way, that was the situation. Make sure you re-sideboard, as always, especially... when you're winning in for the top 8 of a Pro Tour, that's a good time to check your deck list.
Yeah.
Anyways, next card of the week, Neil's card of the week this week, is unexpectedly absent. All right, so our main topic this week is decks that you tried but failed to make work for the Pro Tour. Actually, on the note of unexpectedly absent, though, that card is another sweet one you can play in the Legacy Lantern port, because you can unexpectedly absent and then Codex Shredder. That's a combo. So, you know. Powerful Legacy interaction right there. Anyways, back to the main topic here. So, Ben, tell me about your journey that led you from wherever you started to Bilbao playing Modern. When did this journey start, and what was the first deck that you kind of tested for the format?
Oh, I mean, the journey started a long, long time ago, because we knew we were playing Modern for a while, and you can test, you know, it's pretty unlikely that whatever the new set is going to affect that much,
yeah.
Right? Rivals
Vixalon in particular has had one of the least impacts that a set has ever had on Modern.
We did end up trying one card in Rivals of Vixalon, I think. More on that later.
Okay.
But, yeah, so basically a long time ago, I just wrote down a list. I went through every single card, really? I'm not sure. I think it was every single card, or maybe every single rare and mythic in Modern that was printed since Oath of the Gatewatch, which was the last Modern Pro Tour, and I wrote down every card that I thought had a snowball's chance of getting played, and then I like did one pass, and then I like did a second pass and like culled some out, and eventually I like ended up at like a small list of cards that I sort of wanted to test. I didn't really get around to testing all of them, because when I say small list, I mean it's like a list of like 20 cards or something like that. But I did think about a lot of them, like trying to put them in decks and stuff. Like, for example, Emrakul the Promised End.
Oh, yeah.
Is a card that I never actually built a deck with, but I spent a while thinking about, like, what an Emrakul deck would look like and if I could make one that was reasonably competitive for Modern. I decided that I could not.
Okay.
Let's see. So now for a card that I actually did think that I could maybe make it competitive in Modern... So this is like sort of a pet card of mine also, because I try to make it work in Standard as well, but it's Indomitable Creativity.
Okay, what's that do?
Indomitable Creativity is a sorcery for red, red, red X.
Not liking where that's going.
Destroy X target artifacts and or creatures. For each permanent destroyed this way, its controller reveals cards from the top of his or her library until an artifact or creature card is revealed and exiles that card. Those players put the exiled cards onto the battlefield, then shuffle their libraries.
Okay.
So the way that you want to play with this card is that you want to use it to cheat Emrakul into play. Emrakul the Aeon Storm.
Okay.
Now, the way you can do that... Now, not only can you put Emrakul, the Aeon's Torn, in play, but you can also put Lightning Greaves in play.
Okay. That's a way combo. To give Emrakul
haste.
Yeah, okay.
So, you can do that by playing cards that are not creatures or artifacts, but that make creatures or artifacts.
So, Master's Call, that kind of thing? 2 and a white, make 2/1/1 colorless mirror artifact creature tokens?
Yeah, so I actually settled on Dragon Fodder, as it's in color and cheaper.
Wait, but that makes non-artifacts. You don't have to destroy artifacts?
It's destroy X target artifacts and or creatures.
And or creatures. Ah, okay.
So you get to polymorph
artifacts
or creatures into artifacts or creatures.
Okay.
So yeah, I played Dragon Fodder and Krenko's Command, which is just another copy of Dragon Fodder.
Any Hordling Outbursts?
No. Because you only need 2.
Okay.
To get the Emrakul and the Lightning Greaves. And then the Indomitable Creativity costs 5. Plus and so actually...
Yeah, okay.
Red X for X equals 2 is 5, right?
Okay, yeah.
And so actually, Polymorph decks have sort of... You know, Polymorph has been a card that's legal in Modern for, like, forever. So, first, before I decided to make this deck, I had to sort of convince myself that Indomitable Creativity is actually a better card than Polymorph. Well, to start off with, you know, it's possible that now that you have 8 polymorph effects, the deck becomes, like, consistent enough that it's better. But I quickly found out after playing it that polymorph is just horrible. Like, the card polymorph is really bad. The main problem with polymorph is that removal interacts with it. So, like, your big combo finish, you know, you polymorph your token, and then they just kill your token with Fatal Push, and your spell's countered, and you don't get anything, and it's horrible.
Whereas, how is that not true with Indomitable Creativity?
Well, with Indomitable Creativity, you can target, if you have more tokens, which often happens because, you know, you just draw multiple copies of Dragon Fodder or whatever, you can target, you know, you can do it, you can target like 3 or 4 tokens.
So if you have more mana, you can cast for more and then you still...
Right, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
So then, even if they have, you know, they need a removal spell for each card more than you have 2 tokens. Right?
Right, yeah.
So this lets you actually play around removal, whereas with Polymorph, it's just impossible. Now, Polymorph is cheaper, like costs less mana, and that's good, but I think Indomitable Creativity is actually a huge upgrade on Polymorph. Like, I think the Polymorph combo is just literally unplayable, and I think the Indomitable Creativity combo is not good enough, but still playable if you just, like, want to have fun or you want to try a different kooky combo. Another cool thing about the card Indomitable Creativity is that you can target your opponent's artifacts. So this came up frequently when I would play against Lantern, actually, because, you know, if they have Bridge in play, you can't attack with Emrakul. They'll just, you know, they're not likely to have 15 cards in their hand. But you can Indomitable Creativity your tokens and their Ensnaring Bridge. And so it polymorphs their Ensnaring Bridge into some other artifacts, which is probably, I don't know, like a Lantern or a Rock or a Mox Opal or whatever. And then you get Emrakul, and then you hit them and they die.
That sounds like a powerful interaction, yeah. Good synergy.
Yeah, so, like, this is something... You can also target... targeting Oathstone never really came up, but, you know, you can mess with your opponent's artifacts a little bit. So, yeah, this was, like, a deck that I was trying. I ended up not liking it that much because it turned out that just frequently attacking with Emrakul on turn 5 or 6... I was playing Rituals also, so it was more... It was, like, turn 4, 5, or 6. It just, like, actually wasn't good enough to win the game kind of often, which is kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, like, well, that's always been the problem with, like, the, you know, all-in through the breach strategies is that, yeah, your opponent loses... you know, 6 or all of their permanents and 15 life, but you've done everything that, like, that's all you've done.
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem with the Through the Breach one. That was another reason I was attracted to this combo. That is a problem with the Through the Breach deck, but with this one, you get to keep the Emrakul.
Oh, and that still wasn't good enough?
You just get to attack them next turn. Yeah, the problem was, like, when I would play against humans, like, they would be disruptive enough to, or slow me down enough that by the time I could get Emrakul into play, it would be...
Like, you couldn't attack?
I would be at like 5 and they would have 7 and they would have like 8 permanents in play. So if I attack, I just get attacked back for lethal.
That's embarrassing.
Yeah, and it happened against like Dredge and Affinity also. it was just really awkward that it, you know, I did my combo, like I did my thing, and it just wasn't good enough to win, like maybe 20% of the time that I did my thing. And then, you know, another 30 to 40% at least, you just don't get to do your thing because you die or you don't draw the right cards or whatever. And so, right.
And this deck does not sound like it has a good plan B.
Yeah, the plan B, well, the plan B was Blood Moon.
Okay.
The plan B was play Blood Moon on turn two with Desperate Ritual. You can't play Simeon Spirit Guide because then you could polymorph into it.
That would be bad. That's not a combo.
No, not a combo. So you could Blood Moon people on turn two. I actually won quite a few games just by Blood Mooning and then attacking with Goblin Tokens to win.
Yeah, okay, that sounds pretty good.
It was kind of fun. Like, it was fun just winning games by attacking with Goblin Tokens. And the deck was not that bad, but I decided that it just wasn't good enough.
Okay.
But now that they printed Tormenting Voice that makes two treasures in Standard, Indomitable Creativity may rise again in Standard. Because there's a three-card instant win combo in Standard, which is sweet.
What's the combo in Standard?
It's Whirler Virtuoso, Decoction Module, and Gonti's Aether Heart.
Okay. That lets you take extra turns.
It lets you make infinite tokens and take extra turns. Unfortunately, it does get interacted with by a removal spell, so I need to think of something better. But Tormenting Voice make two treasures is exactly, or Brass's Bounty or whatever that card is called, is
exactly Brass's Bounty is a little bit of a seven drop, but Pirate's Plunder or whatever, Pirate's Pillage. That's really cute with
Indomitable. This is what Indomitable Creativity is looking for. So,
yeah, that's awesome.
I have high hopes.
Yeah, let's get to brewing some Standard decks. That sounds fun. But of course, this was just the first of many Modern decks that you tried for the Pro Tour. So what was the next card after it became clear that you were just not creative enough for the polymorph strategy?
Wow, harsh. So the next card I tried was Elder Deepfiend.
Okay.
Because after playing against Elder Deepfiend in Standard, I felt like the Elder Deepfiend chains are really powerful, where you just make your opponent skip like a bunch of their turns. And Elder Deepfiend is like pretty hard to kill. It doesn't die to Dismember, it doesn't die to Fatal Push, doesn't die to Lightning Bolt. So it's like kind of a powerful threat in Modern. And just the interaction where you just like Elder Deepfiend them, crack Sanctum Vugin, get Reality Smasher, play Reality Smasher, attack them for a billion. Like because of fetch lands and shock lands and stuff, people are just at lower life in Modern, so that's like more likely to be lethal. So I wanted to try to build Elder Deepfiend decks. I built a lot of Elder Deepfiend decks, let me tell you. So first I just tried to slot it into various Eldrazi decks. Right? So I tried to make like a mono blue Eldrazi.
So like an deck. Eldrazi Sky Spawner.
Yeah, so Ruination I played like
a guide aggro deck.
I played Eldrazi Sky Spawner, Matter Reshaper, Venser, Shaper Savant.
Powerful card.
Thought Not Seer, Reality Smasher. This deck unfortunately had basically no interaction because it was mono blue. Like you had like a Dismember. Yeah, you had like a Dismember and like a Venser.
Okay.
Or two. So I didn't really love it. But I also tried like a blue green Eldrazi deck with Elder Deepfiend, which also suffered from like similar problems. And then I tried I took a page out of Standard's book and I tried a Bant Company Elder Deepfiend deck.
Okay. So,
you know, the idea is that you have Voice of Resurgence, which is a really good card to sacrifice to Elder Deepfiend, and you have Reflector sort Mage. Of. What do you mean, sort of?
Well, it's pretty low converted mana cost.
Well, yeah, but they still die. And, like, the Collected Company decks, like, make a lot of mana.
Yeah, you're right.
And then also you have like Knight of the Reliquary, which is a really big attacker, so it can deal a lot of damage after you tap their blockers or make them skip their turn or whatever. And then you can sacrifice cards like Reflector Mage to Elder Deepfiend and stuff like that. That deck, I did pretty well with it on Magic Online, but it was like pretty unclear if the Elder Deepfiend part of my deck was actually like relevant or impacting games at all. Because basically, like, the rest of my deck was just a Modern deck, right? And then I just sort of put a Sanctum of Ugin, because the other thing I liked about it is that you can find Sanctum of Ugin with Knight of the Reliquary.
Oh, that is cute, yeah.
Yeah, so you can double Deep Fiend them pretty often. I also put Ramunap Excavator in my deck.
That's a nice combo
You can go Sanctum, Ramunap Excavator, Elder Deep Fiend, and you can time walk them for 3 turns in a row or 4 turns in a row, depending on how many Deep Fiends you're playing. That was pretty fun. That was a sweet deck that I did decently well with, but I ended up deciding that the Elder Deep Fiend part was actually just not really impacting my wins at all, and I would probably have won if the Elder Deep Fiend was like any other card pretty easily. And playing Sanctum of Ugin, there's like a pretty big cost when you're playing a 3-color deck. Sometimes you draw it and it doesn't produce colored mana.
It's a bit of an ombo.
Yeah.
Okay.
So one other Elder Deep Fiend deck I tried was like an affinity deck. Like literally the cards that have affinity. So I played Mur Enforcer. Frogmite. Because you can sacrifice Frogmite to Elder Deep Fiend.
I see the combo. That's sweet. So the plan is to turbo Deep Fiends because you get these creatures with high converted mana cost that actually didn't cost you much mana.
Yeah, exactly. And also, Mur Enforcer triggers Sanctum of Ugin.
That's a combo.
Yeah. That interaction is pretty powerful, actually. And maybe at some point could be reasonable in the future. I don't know. I'm still keeping this deck in my back pocket because it has some problems, but it's pretty powerful. That interaction is pretty powerful. And this particular like artifact style deck is quite good against Stony Silence, actually, because Mur Enforcer doesn't care about Stony Silence. Elder Deep Fiend doesn't care about Stony Silence. Right now, unfortunately, people are mostly playing Ancient Grudge instead of Stony Silence or like Ceremonious Rejection. And those cards are very good against this deck, so it doesn't really dodge the hate like you'd want it to. But there could be a metagame at some point where it does. One big problem with this deck was that it was really, really, really hard to cast Elder Deep Fiend for the emerge cost, because it costs double blue, and like you have to play Darksteel Citadel.
You're playing Blink. Citadel, Sanctum of Ugin, and since you're trying to turbo this, you just don't have very many lands in play when you're trying to do this on turn 3 or 4 or whatever.
Yeah, you have to play Citadel, you have to play Sanctum of Ugin. Blinkmoth Nexus is just a really, really good card, so
yeah,
you know, you want to play that. I ended up playing Chromatic Stars in my deck to both count for affinity and to like fix your mana for Elder Deep Fiend. They were okay, but
yeah, that doesn't sound optimal. This is maybe the kind of deck where if they unban the artifact lands, we'll be casting our Elder Deep Fiends off Seat of the Synod real fast.
If they unban Seat of the Synod, I will definitely revisit this deck, and it will be sweet.
Okay, that sounds like a really cool idea, though. That's a nice little brew that had potential.
Yeah, at some point, also, I had an iteration that had, I don't remember if this particular deck had Elder Deep Fiend in it, but, you know, there's already an all-in affinity contested Warzone deck that people play, or, like, that has existed.
Contested Warzone is that land that, like, taps to give attacking creatures +1/+0, but if you get hit, your opponent gains control of it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Signal Pest and those sorts of cards. And I tried building that deck with Maverick Thopterist in it. Maverick Thopterist is nice with Contested Warzone, let me tell you. But Contested Warzone is not a very good card, is the other problem. So
right, yeah.
But now that you mention it, I hope they unban Seat of the Synod. I never really thought about that before, but man, this deck would get a lot better if they do.
Yeah, it's not really one speculation I've seen is that if they were to ban Mox Opal, then it would be maybe safe to unban the Artifact Lands, but I remain unconvinced that the Artifact Lands are pretty fundamentally broken.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if they unbanned the Artifact Lands, they just wouldn't, you just wouldn't play them in Affinity.
No, but you might play them
in like other broken decks like KCI or maybe this deck or, you know, stuff like that.
Okay. The next thing that I've just seen. So are we done with Elder Deep Fiend decks, or are there more of those that you want to talk about?
I think that was all of them that I tried.
Okay.
Yeah, the main ones were the Affinity one, the Company one, and the Eldrazi one.
I see here that now you want to talk about Hardened Scales, which apparently is one of the many things that they were banned from testing in the Channel Fireball testing group.
Wait, really?
Yeah, apparently they were banned from testing Hardened Scales, Terrarian in a Scape Shift deck for some reason, and Niv-Magis Elemental, which, you know, obviously there's some history with that card, so they just didn't want to test any of these because maybe it would take too much time from real ideas.
Okay, I was there for this, and Hardened Scales was certainly not banned.
Okay, well.
So I don't know where you got your information, but
I've perhaps been lied to.
Anyway.
Hardened Scales, by the way, a card that's somehow still worth like more than a dollar, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, people have played like a modern. There is like a modern Hardened Scales deck that I guess, you know, has existed, or people have played with it before, and we were working on a Hardened Scales deck for the PT, and it was not my idea. It was Matt Nass's idea.
Right, he was the originator of the standard deck as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
That was the one that we all got tricked into playing at GP Dallas.
What do you mean tricked into playing? I got a pro point.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I made it as well at that tournament, but it was not trying to get those Abzan Falconers that day was one of the most harrowing experiences of my life.
That was funny. But yeah, we tried a Hardened Scales deck with like Steel Overseer, Hangerback Walker, Walking Ballista, Arcbound Ravager, Arcbound Worker. You can do some crazy stuff real fast with Hardened Scales. Yeah, Arcbound
Worker sounds sweet because you get like it's a 2/2 that dies for 3 counters onto something.
Yeah, you can like if you have Ballista and Hangerback Walker and Ravager and Arcbound Worker, I think they're just dead actually.
Yeah, that sounds pretty lethal.
Yeah, so we played around with a deck like this. We ended up not liking its post-board matchups. Like, its pre-board matchups were pretty good. I guess it's not that surprising because it's like kind of like Affinity, although less of an Affinity deck.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like your Hardened Scales is just kind of your Cranial Plating type card, right? Where that's the thing that adds all the power to the board and kills them.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay.
We had a problem where, like, Mox Opal wasn't that good in the deck because it didn't have very many 0 or 1 mana artifacts. Like, it had too many 2 drops.
Right.
Like, the deck was just, like, all 2 drops, basically, which was a problem. And we just couldn't really get the post-sideboard games to work out very well. Like, just the artifact hate cards that people were bringing were just really good. Like, Wear Tear or Ancient Grudge, just very hard to beat. Hangerback Walker goes a long way there, but the rest of the deck, if you just didn't draw Hangerback Walker or it got Thought Seized or whatever, you're just in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, it sounds like the kind of strategy that's pretty easily preyed upon in a format like Modern. But cool to have tried it. That deck sounds like it maybe is a card or two away from being really, really broken.
Yeah, I think so. If we could just play 8 Arcbound Workers, I think it would be good, actually.
Right, yeah. That's certainly something that could happen, so. All right, next deck that you tried. And I see the word Eldrazi again. This kind of
I mean, we all know I'm an Eldrazi scientist.
Yeah.
So, basically, I really, 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 really love the card Eldrazi Obligator.
Oh, I love that card,
because
too.
Because it's basically Lava Axe.
Yeah.
But it actually does a lot more damage than Lava Axe. It's usually good for, like, 8 to 9 damage. So I built like a red-green Eldrazi deck, like heavily based off of Bant Eldrazi.
Okay.
Just like in the construction of the deck. So like it's very similar. It's got Ancient Stirrings. It has Mana Dorks. It has a 1 mana interactive spell, which is Lightning Bolt instead of Path to Exile. And then it has, you know, 8 3-drop Eldrazi, Thought Not Seer, Reality Smasher. The 6-drop has actually Endbringer instead of Drowner because... that's just the best 6-mana Eldrazi, basically, that isn't blue. And so this deck was just like a sort of different take on the Eldrazi strategy. The idea behind it being that Obligator is better against Tron and Death Shadow.
Yeah, Obligator on a card like Death Shadow or Wurmcoil Engine, that's the game right there.
Yeah, I mean, Obligator just straight up kills Death Shadow in a non-stubborn, deniable way pretty frequently. And if it doesn't kill Death Shadow, often it just kills them.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of games where your opponent, you know, if they're playing Death Shadow, they're at like five, and they have a block, like one creature in play. So if you just draw Obligator, they just die on the spot, usually. Or they have to kill their own creature. And then you also get to play four Grove of the Burn Willows, which is really good against Death Shadow. And then, of course, if you're playing against Tron, you just, a lot of the times they'll just play a Wurmcoil Engine to stabilize, and then you just steal it and they die. So this deck is sweet. This deck, I almost played it, actually. Basically, I felt like I might have fallen into a trap where I was just, I was winning a lot with it on Magic Online, like a lot. And so were other people. But then when we got to the testing house and we actually started playing versus each other, we were winning a lot less. And so I sort of got scared off the deck because of that. It also is not very good against humans. And we expected humans to be very popular at the PT.
That was a good prediction. That deck was the dominant deck of the metagame, clocking in at 9%.
Yeah, it was the most popular deck, but it was a lot smaller than we thought it would be. So we thought it would be more like 15 or 20%, and it was 9%. So
speaking of which, like, kudos to Wizards for the modern format somehow being this diverse. It's really, yeah, really impressive. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there hasn't been a high-profile modern tournament for 2 years.
Yeah, I think people are also just kind of unwilling to change their decks. I don't know. Like, I doubt that there should be this many decks. I doubt that if everyone is playing optimally that there actually should be this many decks in modern. But, you know, they're, like, close enough.
Yeah. Anyway, so that kind of scared you off the red-green Eldrazi deck? Do you have any regrets? Do you,
Well, my constructed record was extremely medium, so I wish I had played a different deck, I guess. One of my teammates played it and went 7-3, which is pretty good. And I just love the Eldrazi strategies, as everyone knows. So I guess I do kind of regret not playing it. I might play it this weekend in Toronto.
Ooh, good luck. That's a lot of travel there, you know, all over the world.
Oh, yeah, it's not easy. But I have to make up for the GPs that I missed, so.
Right, yeah. Hopefully you don't miss this one.
Yeah.
That'd be a blowout.
But yeah, this deck is sweet. Mostly just Eldrazi Obligator is just a delight to play with. It's just so fun. And, you know, you got your good old fashioned favorites, Thought Not Seer, Reality Smasher. Lightning Bolt, Obligator, and Smasher all play together really well. Right, because they all pressure your opponent's life total really heavily. Mm-hmm. So it's like a pretty big departure from like Drowner, Displacer, which is like more of a control thing. Like, I played Bant Eldrazi, like a lot of the times I would like morph into a control deck in other mid-range matchups, I guess, where you would just try to assemble the Displacer-Drowner combo and then like kill them two turns later. But this deck is very different, where you try to push in damage a lot, like as much as you can. Because once they're down to a low life total, like all it takes is like a bolt and a smasher and they die. Or like an obligator and a bolt and then they die.
Any like deck playing a threaten effect, you know that feel, or Lavax effect really, where you just know the feel of like you know something your opponent doesn't, which is their life total is not as high as they think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that feeling playing a game of Magic. It's I think that's one of the things that you of all people best understand is the joy of you know, lava axing people.
Oh yes.
All right, tell me about this next deck, Temur Moon. What's going on here? I know that Temur is a lot of colors and Moon is one color, so.
Yeah, I mean, this is like a deck that Gerard Fabiano played, I guess.
Right, so it's like an evolution of the Blue Moon strategy, right?
Yeah, it's like Blue Moon, but you splash like green for Tarmogoyf.
Yeah, okay.
And Tireless Tracker. This was a deck that some people were interested in on our team, and I tested it a reasonable amount. It was, like, pretty good. It's, like, a nice, grindy mid-range deck if you're in for that sort of thing. It's very Jundy, despite being Temur-y. You know, you get to play your Snapcaster Mages and your Lightning Bolts and your Cryptic Commands, and then you also just get to cheese people out with Blood Moon and Spreading Seas sometimes. So that gives you, like, an interesting other angle of attack. at the end of the day, I decided that the interaction that is offered by red and blue is just not, and green, is just not really up to par with the rest of the format. This deck finds it extremely difficult to kill a Death Shadow. Like,
that's a problem.
It's basically impossible to kill a Death Shadow once it's in play. You have, like, you can play some engineered explosives, but that's about it. Which, yeah, is a problem. Is a big problem. And that kind of scared me off the deck. I also think that counter spells are just worse than discard spells in general. Or, like, from this type of strategy. Like, discard spells can let you, like, proactively protect your Blood Moon or whatever, or your sorcery speed threats. But, you know, counter spells are not great when you're, like, tapping. I mean, I guess your threats are, like, cheap enough that it's not a huge issue. Like, Tarmogoyf only costs 2, Tireless Tracker only costs 3. But.
Yeah, but it's like, what are the good counter spells in the format? Cryptic Command, a card that requires 3 islands in play if you have Blood Moon?
Well, yeah, but I mean, people have been doing that since time immemorial.
Yeah, but it's harder when you're also trying to make green sources for Tarmogoyf. Like,
yeah.
That's a pretty serious strain on the mana base.
I think Cryptic Command and Blood Moon are actually a pretty good combo because Cryptic Command just, like, finishes the lock. Like, when you Blood Moon them, they have a pretty small number of outs to get out from under the Blood Moon, and Cryptic Command just shuts the door. Or sometimes Blood Moon also just frequently restricts their ability to play more than one spell a turn. Like, they basically can't. Like, they can only play one spell a turn.
Right.
And Cryptic Command is just so good if your opponent can only cast one spell a turn.
Yeah, I was watching. I watched the Pro Tour, and there's some savage Blood Moon games. Like, there was one in which the player just had 7 spells in hand, and they were all, like, Thought Not Seers and Reality Smashers, and they just had no colorless sources in play because all their lands are mountains. That was really made me shed a tear for the poor player's plight.
I think one thing I did learn from this deck, though, is that Tireless Tracker is a really good card.
Yeah, I've been you know, itching at the chance. I've been looking at some of the modern decks, and some of the ones that really excite me are the ones that play, like, the, you know, Ramunap Excavator, Ghost Quarter strategy type thing, and Tireless Tracker, really good combo with Ramunap Excavator too.
Yeah, actually, on that note, one other deck we tried, we basically tried the Todd Stevens green white.
Turboland.
I don't really know how to assign it to an archetype.
I've heard Turboland is the name people call that deck.
All right, sure. Green white Turboland.
Tell us what the key cards for this deck are, though. Yeah.
So this is like a collected company deck that instead of, like, playing a combo or, like, aggressive or, like, efficient creatures, it just sort of plays dirtily card advantage creatures like Courser of Kruphix and Tireless Tracker, and then, like, it eventually just tries to Ghost Quarter all your lands.
Yeah.
It's really hard to describe the deck, actually. It has a really bizarre game plan. But
it's sort of a prison, like, kind of.
Yeah, but it's not like you're Leon and Arbitering them, right? Like, they still get to get basic. You're just literally running them out of basics in their deck because you're Ghost Quartering them so many times.
Right, I mean, it does not take, like, if you're ever playing against this deck, you know you're on, like, a pretty quick clock before you're out of those basics in your deck because you're playing, like, most modern decks play 2 to 5 basics.
Yeah, so Field of Ruin also got printed, which is, like, another Ghost Quarter.
Right.
So, like, that made the deck a little better. And the deck used to play Azusa.
Mm-hmm.
So you could Ghost Quarter them, like, 8 million times. So we tried playing it with a Wayward Swordtooth.
Right, yeah.
Which is, like, a 5/5 Azusa that can't attack or block until you get the City's Blessing. And that didn't work out super great. Some people liked the deck for a little while, but eventually I think we decided that it was just a little too weak. And also the City's Blessing is a little unreliable.
Yeah, I've seen Jim Davis try to build that in Standard with Wayward Swordtooth, Ramunap Excavator, Field of Ruin, and trying to, you know, make some thematic compasses flip and win that way. That ended up just the best part of that got adapted into his Bant Approach strategy, but it's definitely it's a little tenuous and modern to. You know, it's just pretty likely that you're going to die before you actually get all that assembled.
Yeah. Playing against that deck taught me that Courser of Kruphix is a pretty good card in Modern, actually.
Oh, yeah. It's 2/4. Like, the 4 toughness. That fourth point of toughness is really...
Yeah. Playing against it with my Lightning Bolt Eldrazi Obligator deck was pretty frustrating. Just incapable of killing a Courser of Kruphix ever.
Yeah, that's a little bit of an embarrassing card to line up with there.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So that's Temur Moon. Then, so tell me, what deck did you end up playing for the Pro Tour? Because you didn't play any of these that you tried.
No, I didn't. I didn't think any of them were good enough. I just ended up playing Affinity. I decided that, you know, some schmo is going to get to draw Mox Opal a bunch of times in their opening hand. And why shouldn't that schmo be me?
Right. And the answer is because you didn't deserve it and you didn't try hard enough.
I guess so. I don't know.
You didn't Modern correctly.
I feel like my Modern tournament went, like, kind of exactly average, I guess.
Right.
I played a lot of bad matchups for Affinity, but I actually won most of them. So that was kind of weird. Like, I played Jeskai Control 4 times.
Ooh, yeah, that's not
and
not a good
that's,
one.
Like, one of the worst, like, one of the worst Affinity matchups, and I went 3-1 against it. Which I guess is a point of pride, but, like, I don't know. I definitely would not have played Affinity if I had expected to play against Jeskai 4 times. I lost really close matches to Death Shadow, which was unfortunate, and I don't know. I think I just my tournament was average and my record was average.
Okay. Well, cool. I guess let's quickly just, I've got some statistics here about the impact of Rivals of Ixalan on the Modern format. So of the cards in Rivals of Ixalan, if we exclude the card Negate, of which there were quite a few copies and decks playing that in the format, only 2 Rivals of Ixalan cards saw play in this Pro Tour. Direfleet Daredevil saw a little bit of play as a sideboard card in Humans. What do you think about that, by the way? Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I think that card is quite good. It's very good with you when you have Vile. I haven't actually played any games with it, but it does seem like a very powerful card. And
I've seen it cast Opt on turn 3 in Limited. Let me tell you, that's a powerful feel-bad moment for the player who cast the Opt initially.
Well, I imagine that happens plenty in Modern when you put it in your deck.
Yeah, no, I mean, anytime you sideboard it in, Modern, of course, it's normal for it to cast great one-drop spells because the format's full of them, but in Rivals Limited, that's a little bit more of a blowout.
Honestly, I kind of wanted to try it in Red-Green Eldrazi because even if your opponent is playing, like, a deck that doesn't typically have a lot of spells or, like, useful spells, like Tron or Lantern or whatever, they still have Ancient Stirrings, and Ancient Stirrings is so good in Eldrazi. So flashbacking that one is still good.
Oh, that's cute,
But I didn't ever actually do it.
Okay, and the other Rivals of Ixalan card that saw a little bit of play was 2 copies of Blood Sun in 1 deck. But other than that, that was just, in one green-red Tron player's sideboard. Which just makes sense. Blood Sun, you know, reasonable. It has a good interaction with the Tron lands. While also being a good, land shutdown effect on some of the other lands in the format, but...
Yeah, I mean, the main way people destroy Tron lands is with Ghost Quarter and Field of Ruin, so Blood Sun is a way to protect against that.
Yeah, it's...
And also just, like, randomly cheese out half of your opponent's lands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hitting the fetch lands is really a big game if you're a deck that doesn't have any and can play Blood Sun, so it's possible that more Blood Sun should have been played in the tournament, but it's tough because it's, like, you have to be playing a deck that doesn't really have fetch lands, or else you might just... end up hurting yourself more than your opponent.
Yeah, also, I don't think it's that good, so...
Mm-hmm. You do draw a card when you play it, though, so that's powerful.
Yeah, that's true, but it also, like, is just a little slow to be destroying people's lands.
But I do think that it's possible that card... You know, maybe there's a way that Wayward Swordtooth can see play, if you're looking for the 5th through 8th copies of Azusa for some reason. That could be cool. I know that there were... Before the Pro Tour itself, there were some rumblings of, Amuletless Titan Bloom still being, Bloomless Amulet Titan still being a deck that might see some play, but didn't look like that actually turned out to be something. Did you get any testing with that?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
There are too many horrible decks in Modern for us to test all of them, Tristan.
Is there anything that you wish you'd tested but didn't have time for? And, you know, any ideas you had that, you know, got away, but if you had another week, you might have tried out?
No, probably if I had another week, I just would have gotten more reps with different decks that already existed.
Okay, let's talk about a little bit about the decks that did do well at the Pro Tour. What is your opinion on some of the breakout decks of the format? Talk to me about Lantern Control. What do you think? Do you think that that's the best deck in the format?
No. I think it's a good deck, but I don't think it's the best deck in the format. Maybe it is the best deck in the format, but I don't think it's like significantly better than the other decks.
I think I agree with you. Yeah, I think it's cool that the deck won the Pro Tour.
I mean, some deck has to win the Pro Tour, right? Like,
right. Lantern Control, like, I mean,
it's not like it had a dominant performance.
Right. It is kind of like a bit of an annoying deck to be really popular because it does have really long round times and...
Oh, God, it's horrible.
Know, pretty warning-intensive gameplay, like where, you have to reveal the top card of your deck, and that's kind of... Even Luis Salvato, like, basically every game he forgot to reveal the top card of his deck for a turn somewhere in there. But yeah,
wouldn't he have received a game loss at some point if that happened?
Well, he never seemed to receive a warning for it, so.
Oh, okay.
That's Who knows what was really going on there, but.
I mean, it's almost certainly beneficial to reveal the top card of your library in that deck, so.
Right.
I can't imagine that he was doing it on purpose.
No, I don't think he was either. He did receive a game loss for the Witchbane Orb incident, which is already, you know, that was pretty harsh, and he was in the unfortunate position of being paired down when he could have been paired across and drawn in, so.
Yeah, well, that was due to breakers. That was not...
Right, I mean, there was no randomness in the final round of pairings, technically. Those are generated completely algorithmically. Anyways.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think Lantern Control is a miserable deck to play against, and I hate it.
Yeah.
But, like, I don't think that it's too good or bannable or anything.
If the deck is miserable to play against and you hate it and it's like slow and makes rounds go to time, like those are arguments for banning a deck.
Oh, I would not shed any tears, but I think Wizards doesn't want to ban things in Modern.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if they can avoid it, like the format is so good right now, they should probably not touch it.
I also think that Modern is a good haven for people who want to buy a deck and play it forever.
Right.
And because of that, Wizards should try extremely hard not to ban any cards in Modern.
Yeah, it's tough as well, because, like, what are you going to ban out of Lantern that doesn't... Like, the most powerful cards in the deck are Ancient Stirrings and Mox Opal, both of which, if you ban them, would affect, you know, a lot of different decks. You could ban just Ensnaring Bridge or Lantern of Insight, but... You know, a Lantern of Insight ban in Modern would be akin to a Rampaging Ferrosson ban in Standard in terms of
how
embarrassing a card it is on the ban list.
That's not true at all. Like, that's an integral part of their strategy.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a Sensei's Divining Top ban in Legacy, which obviously they did.
But, like, it's clear that, you know, if you're playing Standard, you can expect things to get banned nowadays, so...
Well, I think they'd really want to avoid that. I think that if possible, they'd like to have zero bans in Standard for the next 5 years. And
I think they should try really, 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 really hard not to ban anything in Modern.
Okay.
So even though I hate Lantern Control, I do not expect to see anything banned.
Yeah, I think that if Lantern Control, like, does, you know, it sees... Because, okay, just won the Pro Tour, there's going to be an uptick in people playing with and, you know, teching for the deck. And... If the uptick in people being ready for Lantern doesn't cause it to not... Like, if it keeps doing great and it, you know, does, if it starts winning a lot of tournaments, then I think we might have, you know, something that's bannable. But I think that they should not do it unless it's clear that the format is hurting for Lantern being great. And we're nowhere near that stage, so I agree. I think for the time being, every card in Modern should be pretty safe. So what are you going to play in Toronto?
I don't know. I might play Eldrazi. I might play Humans. I'm not going to play Death Shadow because I just don't, that's just not really my style of deck and I don't really have a lot of reps with it. I guess Sam Party could convince me to play Eldrazi Tron, but probably not.
Eldrazi Tron was one of the best performing decks at the Pro Tour.
Well, it wasn't for Sam Pardee, let me tell you that.
Just even despite his record with the deck, it was one of the best, like, of the decks which had, you know, sufficient number of pilots to have meaningful data, it had one of the highest win rates in the tournament.
Huh. Maybe I should play it.
So, just food for thought. The deck's pretty great. I had a good experience playing with it as well. Very powerful deck. But
I had a good experience with you playing it also.
Okay, all right. No need to... no need to, you know, kick me when I'm down, but I think you should play Red-Green Eldrazi. I think that would be cool. I think you should, you know... I think Modern rewards people that do bold and new things, and I think that, you know, you sleeving up a new Eldrazi deck has always worked out well in the past, and I think it'd be cool. And I think people won't be ready for it, so you'll get a lot of edge by people playing poorly against you.
It is... not hard to kill people who are not trying to play around Eldrazi Obligator.
Yeah, and, you know, I think particularly in a GP field, people are not going to figure out what you're doing at the same in the same way that they might at a PT field. So
I agree.
Sleeve it up. You know, make it happen. I would love to see you in the top eight. But if you do top eight, you know, remember in the little piece of paper they give you to mention the podcast.
I did it last time.
I know,
did
yeah.
Did you read it?
I did. That was very...
And I told Neil to do it.
I know. I told both of you to do it by Facebook message.
That's well, we didn't have our phones on, so...
Oh, okay. Well, that was really clever of you to figure it out without me having to remind you. That's, you know, every weekend, every time, you know, Ben and Neil start doing well at a tournament, I'm just kind of glued to the Twitch stream, ready to remind them to plug the podcast if they top eight. That's my contribution to their magic success, so...
Yeah, one day, Tristan, I might even get to tell you to remember to plug the podcast.
Fingers crossed. Fingers crossed. But anyways, I think that, you know, we've done a good job here of talking about some magic without our good friend Neil to guide us. So he'll return next week probably. And yeah, Ben, would you like to tell us maybe a story from the professional tour of Magic?
Sure. So this story concerns my friend Tommy Ashton, who is playing against an opponent at the Pro Tour. Now Tommy is playing Bogles.
Ugh.
So. Tommy has just attacked with a Bogle and gained a large quantity of life. And his opponent is playing some sort of aggressive deck, which involves a lot of complicated math. I forget exactly which deck it is. Maybe it's Affinity, maybe it's Humans. I don't care. It doesn't matter. The point is, Tommy's opponent is trying to count up the amount of damage that they have. And it's like somewhat complicated. So they count it. They count it again, and Tommy is just sitting there going like, what is this person doing? There's no way that they have lethal. I've just gained so much life from my creature. There's just no chance this actually kills me. And the opponent is just sitting there counting. So Tommy's at like 13 or something. Opponent counts to 12, counts again, counts to 13, counts again, counts to 13. Counts again, counts to 12, you know, over and over. And eventually, opponent finally counts. It's like, okay, I've got it. And opponent attacks. Opponent's like, all right, attack you for 13. You're dead. And Tommy's like, can I block? And opponent's like, oh, blockers. Tommy just has this giant life-linking Bogle that's untapped because it has vigilance. So... And that is how he won very, very easily.
And that's this week of Allied Strategies. But join us again next week, when we'll unite again with more Allied Strategies. And Neil's better at this than me.
Yeah, no kidding. I was going to say mulligan ends. Mulligan closing.
About when Neil starts talking is, you know, he's going to be going for a good couple minutes.
So yeah.
You get time to drink some water and
browse
your throat.
Browse some Twitter.
Oh, yeah. Kind of zone out, and then Neil says your name, and you're like, oh, I have to. You're just like,
sorry, guys, I disconnected. What happened?